less than 1% of fashion textiles are currently recycled. Is that true?
Yeah, the challenge that the industry is facing now is how we create a whole new infrastructure to actually enable recycling.
Welcome, Lauren Junastrandil. Your work crosses over from textiles, supply chains, even consumer behaviours.
UKFT is the UK Fashion Textiles Association, the largest network of designers, brands, retailers, manufacturers, suppliers and educators within fashion textiles in the UK, and therefore we have that power to bring together the industry. We can't assume that everyone knows about sustainability and about all of these complex topics that are coming up, such as green claims or EU legislation. If you look at the actual real composition of a t-shirt, sometimes it's scary to see how many different types of fibers are there. So that's why we also want to transition to 100% recyclable garments and using single fibers, because that's going to make the process of recycling much easier.
Positive innovation. Is there any that excites you, that you think are game changers?
From a recycling perspective, I think automation, robotics and AI is going to help a lot. Fiber recognition, and we sort and process textiles so they can meet different requirements, whether they are going to reuse or whether they are going to recycling.
Ideally, I think it is about reducing our need for physical items.
Yes, we're not there yet.
So welcome, Lauren Junastrandil. You are the Sustainability and Innovation Network Manager at the UKFT, which we'll speak a little bit about what that is. And you're also a PhD candidate at the University of the Arts London, where you're evaluating secondhand clothing consumption. Again, we'll come to that interesting work. Your work crosses over from textiles, supply chains, even consumer behaviours. I feel like you deal with very important and serious topics on a day-to-day. And we're here to try and understand the main challenges that you see through your work, what the industry is facing, but also, most importantly, what positive innovations and efforts are being made. I guess first, can you explain what the UKFT... fashion industry loves an acronym. Can you explain what it means and what your role is within it?
Of course. Thank you for the intro. So UKFT is a UK Fashion and Textiles Association. And what it is basically the largest network of designers, brands, retailers, manufacturers, suppliers, and educators within fashion textiles in the UK. So what we do is basically support the industry in many different practical areas, from compliance to international trade to sustainability and innovation. So we are a membership association, so we basically support our members and promote them across the industry. But then we're also in quite a unique position because we are that large network, and therefore we have that power to bring together the industry and work together in different areas, such as in this case, sustainability and innovation. And my role within it, like you said before, I'm the Innovation Sustainability Network Manager. So what I do is mainly work in those external sustainability projects that we're involved with. We have a sustainability team that also works very closely with our members, and I work there, but mainly in those external sustainability projects.
And how do you deal with working full time and then also doing your PhD?
I get asked that every day. I don't know myself. I guess because it's so interrelated, and at the end, what I do in my PhD helps me to create knowledge to my everyday, in my everyday sort of work and role. I think I see it as interconnected, and I try to always find time, say after work, on the weekends, on my holidays, to keep sort of working on it. But like I said, I think it's just because both things that I'm doing are so interrelated that I see them as one, really. And for me, my PhD, I know is gonna help me loads, and it's helping me loads in my role in UKFT and other things, so.
I definitely align myself with that. I think because I have a startup and then I'm doing my PhD as well, I think they can't kind of exist in silo. I think academia needs to learn from industry, industry needs to work from academia, and sometimes they're quite separate, and I think there needs to be more more collaboration.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing with the field I'm in my PhD, which is sustainable consumption. It's a field at the end that was born because of environmental challenges and real life challenges. So everything, like the sort of purpose of creating knowledge and contributing to knowledge there is to actually translate knowledge into action and use that in the industry. So I guess that also helps me in my role, because with what I'm doing in UKFT, I'm dealing with many areas, but not necessarily consumer behavior, which is what I'm looking at in my PhD. So it complements that missing gap, I guess.
Interesting. Let's go back to the very beginning. Why work in sustainable fashion?
So I think for me, that's sort of an obvious thing, right? Like, I wouldn't have been able to work in the fashion industry if it wasn't within sustainability. I mean, being aware of the problem and not doing anything about it. I think it's sort of a challenge, and I love challenges, but it's a beautiful challenge. And like you said at the beginning, we need to be optimistic about it. I felt like myself, I was optimistic about it. I see it as a sort of journey and challenge, and love to be part of it. So I guess is that driving for change that put me there. But at the same time, something that I wanted to mention as well is that I don't necessarily think there should be sustainable fashion roles. There should, of course, to sort of guide the industry. But at the same time, I think sustainability should be embedded in every position, in every role within the fashion industry. And I think slowly but steadily we're heading there.
Okay, great. Well, hopefully we can have some good examples.
Yeah.
So how do you at UKFT or in your PhD, how do you support the brands you work with to embed sustainable practices into their businesses? Because I think they do see it as a challenge initially, I feel.
Yeah, I think it's about understanding as well where the industry is and where they've been for the last decades. I mean, I think we cannot push anyone to be the most sustainable fashion brand in the world in the next year. You know, I think it's a journey, and I think it's making them part of that journey. We have at UKFT started to really put a lot of effort in that sustainability work in the last 2 years. And I think how we help them, basically, our members have access to that sustainability 101 support to sustainable education, which we believe is super important to those transitions. We can't assume, like you said, that everyone knows about sustainability and about all of these complex topics that are coming up, such as green claims or EU legislation. And so we try to support them with that education, with that one-on-one support. And I guess something that's quite unique about UKFT also is that access to network. So if, for example, an example is a company needs someone to deal with their waste or their excess waste or, you know, their production waste, and they ask for a connection, we try to establish that network to drive sustainability. It's sometimes difficult. I mean, we don't have all of the solutions, but I guess we have that access to the wider network and we can enhance that collaboration.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess it's going to come as a surprise to a lot of brands of all this regulation that you said is coming in. And I guess then you're going to be needed more than ever, aren't you, to kind of help them understand how to best prepare for what's ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I think since the EU strategy for sustainable and circular textiles came out in 2022, that's been sort of guiding the conversation of all these companies that it might not affect them directly if they're operating in the UK, but many of these retailers and brands are also selling in EU countries. And I think it's so difficult to sort of keep track of everything that's happening, especially because there's so many different areas, from digital product passports to green claims to EPR to due diligence. So I think we as well can play that role of sort of communicating what is happening even in EU. We are members of Eurotex, which is the sort of, they're constantly talking about all these different regulations. So we keep track of everything that's happening and try to translate that knowledge into sort of actionable guidelines to our members and the wider industry.
And do you feel like they're like receptive of what you want to have to say to them?
I mean, I think they assume that everyone has to play a role in the change. Even with EPR, that's actually EPR, Extended Producer Responsibility.
Thanks for explaining that. I was like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm always using sort of acronyms. That's actually making producers responsible of whichever product they put on the market. And that's asking, for example, retailer or brand to pay that extra price for actually bringing that t-shirt into the market. And I think that's shifting how they've worked up until now, because up until, let's say, 5 years ago, everything was about producing and selling, and then you forget about that garment. But it's actually changing and shifting that responsibility towards that post-retail responsibility. Mm. Yes, they are receptive. It depends of the company, of course, but I think there's a sort of great drive for change and ambition towards meeting sustainability targets, and whatever that means. We are seeing the industry coming together to meet those goals. But I acknowledge at the same time that it's really difficult to keep track of what's there now, what's obligatory now, what isn't, where should I be? I'm preparing for that, which sometimes also implies a cost. So it is a challenge, but I think the industry is slowly getting ready.
It does feel like something's moving, something's shifting. However, it's still very unclear and very difficult to understand, mm-hmm. I think, as yeah. well, like you said, just to kind of understand what is voluntary and what is not.
Yeah,
I mean, even that at the minute is really unclear.
Exactly. And I mean, in the UK, at the moment, there's not sort of any obligatory EPR or any data product passport guideline or anything as such. But I think that's what it is as well. It's starting to move the industry towards these voluntary agreements and voluntary change before any legislation comes in, because we are seeing ourselves how slowly things go on until a legislation actually becomes sort of obligatory.
Yeah.
It takes a while, and the challenge is now. It is in the next 5 years. Waste is expected to grow. Consumption will grow. So it's also bringing together the industry and meeting those targets without necessarily having that sort of obligation in place for now.
I mean, I guess any change is going to have its teeth and problems, but at least it's going in the right direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we've spoken a bit about like how you help brands, but how do you support, I guess, industry, if we kind of take a step back? Is that any different? Do you have any other programs, initiatives?
We do a lot of work, like I said, internally with our members and with the industry itself. But then we are part of many external sustainability projects. Many of them are academic industry projects, which, like you said before, I see as so key. I mean, we have excellent sort of research centers in the UK in different universities that are really also trying to use their research to drive change in the industry. So we are part of many academic industry projects. But then I guess the biggest program we are in is the Circular Fashion Program, which is a government-funded project that started in 2023 and is ending in 2025. And it's looking at how the UK is going to transition towards circularity in the next 2 years. Mm. And that's a big task. So it has many different pillars. I guess there's three main pillars are sustainable manufacturing, circular business models, and recycling infrastructure. And within that, we are co-chairing one of the projects, which is called the Circular Fashion Innovation Network with the British Fashion Council. And UKFT, particularly because of their connection with manufacturing and with other key stakeholders, we are leading on sustainable manufacturing and recycling infrastructure. It's complex.
Very complex.
Yeah, it's very complex.
It's like a network.
Yeah, it's called the Circular Fashion Innovation Network. And it's
perfect.
It's basically how we bring together stakeholders, organizations, and experts in all these different areas and deciding areas in which to prioritize to lead those sustainable and circular transitions. So that's sort of the overview of it. And then we also have another big project called ACT, which is part of this wider program as well, which is looking to build a plan for the first automated sorting and pre-processing facility for a recycling feedstock. So that's quite exciting.
Okay, can you tell us a bit more about what that that means, what you tell, like, for anybody that's like, what is this, what are all these words, like,
No, I'm gonna explain. So basically, I guess that the challenge that the industry is facing now is how we create a whole new infrastructure to actually enable recycling, because like I mentioned before, up until now, you know, everything has been up until the consumer, and then what happens to the textile or the fashion garment. So how we create that infrastructure for recycling is basically by ensuring that we have appropriate collection on a post-consumer level, and then that we sort and process those textiles so they can meet different requirements, whether they are going to reuse or whether they are going to recycling. If they are going to recycling, I guess from an outside perspective, there's been that assumption of, you know, I throw this, it's going to be recycled. But actually, it's a really difficult task because different recycling technologies have different feedstock requirements in terms of composition and fabric mixes. So we have to ensure that we make that process of providing that feedstock more efficient. And by having a automated sorting and pre-processing automated plant, what we can do is basically ensure that we process that feedstock so it comes out meeting the requirements of the recyclers. Okay. So if a recycler has a polycotton blend requirement, the automated sorting and pre-processing facility will sort of give that, or it will give feedstock for downcycling or for other recycling methods. I think it's a complicated topic, but basically that's the summary of it.
I mean, it does sound amazing, because obviously you're kind of been able to send something to a facility with experts and people that understand textiles more than the consumer, because, you know, I don't think that the consumer really knows whether the fabric of that t-shirt or something is, what type of fabric it is. Is it blended? Is it, you know, is it virgin material? Probably not, you know, and what they do.
And many times the label itself, I mean...
Oh, it's so confusing. I don't even understand it.
And the standard reaction of a consumer is, oh, it itches, I cut it off. And then you have no information about that garment anymore. And, you know, how are you supposed to separate that, or to actually know where to throw it? So I guess throw it, or just, you know, deposit it for a collection. So I think one of the great things about this facility is that it's going to use novel technologies and automated sort of fiber and composition recognition, so we can actually do that work that maybe consumers are not prepared to do yet.
Amazing. I mean, I found this stat, and I'm a bit skeptical of stats, but it said that less than 1% of fashion textiles are currently recycled at the moment. Is that true? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, according to the stats, and it is, because
shocking.
I mean, in the latest report I read, it says 8% of textiles in the market are recycled. But the reality is that 7% of those are recycled PET bottles. So only 1% are actually a textile-to-textile recycled fibers. Why that is because currently we don't have the appropriate collection processing and sort of sorting methods to make sure that we have that feedstock available for recyclers. And on top of that, there's not sort of commercially ready recycling technologies to deal with all of the different compositions and fibers that we have now in the market. Because if you look at the actual real composition of a t-shirt, sometimes it's scary to see how many different types of fibers are there. So that's why we also want to transition to 100% recyclable garments and using single fibers, because that's going to make the process of recycling much easier.
Well, I'm glad that you're tackling that, because it kind of comes on to, you know, the recent news about Renewcell, who were one of the leading, the leaders in recycling textiles. They recently filed for bankruptcy only a year after opening its flagship factory, which... is not super positive, is it, for the industry? I mean, what does this kind of say for the future of circular fashion? Although you are, it sounds like you are kind of looking at it.
But. Yeah, I was there in September, and, you know, I think it was very sad news. But I think there were two issues that definitely, I think this is going to be a wake up for the industry, really, to realize that, you know, if retailers don't commit commercially now to these technologies and to these new innovations, it's not going to work. So first of all, I think is that the failure of committing to those long-term relationship with these recycling technologies, which I know some companies were doing, but probably not enough. So I think if new recycling technologies have those long-term commitments, it's going to make it much easier. I guess the challenge there is, you know, brands or retailers thinking that the consumer is not ready. But it's a challenge, because even from a legislation perspective, the minimum recycled content is going to come in. So that's going to also drive retailers to do that long-term commitment to recycling. So I think it's sad, but I think it's going to be a wake-up call for the industry. There's amazing technologies out there. I'm sure Renewcell is going to survive, and that we need that long-term commitment. And then on the other hand, I think one of the challenges was that these technologies that are appearing now on, you know, EU countries, they are depending for the initial batches of recycled fibers on post-industrial waste. They're not really using post-consumer waste at the moment.
Okay.
So they're relying on feedstock from manufacturing countries. So we're coming again back to that global supply chain and global shipment to ensure feedstock. And that was one of the things that happened with Renewcell, was that they were depending, even though they were able to process post-consumer, they were depending on feedstock from global manufacturing countries. That's also inefficient itself, like having to send waste again to the other side of the world. So I think we're going to learn from the sort of failures and just change how things are going to be done in the next 5 years. But I'm optimistic. I mean, it's obvious that we need recycling technologies to deal with the problem of waste. So I think recyclers should keep going, basically.
Yeah, and I think it's not just a case of like relying on one particular way of doing it. Maybe we need a multitude of different ways of recycling, from, you know, post-consumerism to what Renewcell are doing, to think, you know, if we have more of that, then there's more options.
Definitely, and we need many different types of recycling. I mean, there needs to be mechanical, there needs to be chemical, and we need to have chemical sort of recycling solutions for the many different blends that we have. Also, because Renewcell, for example, could deal with one type of waste, but it's not that every chemical recycler can deal with every type of waste. They'll have really sort of specific feedstock requirements. So I think it's about understanding, you know, what's out there that cannot be longer reused or sold, and how can we create solutions that match that waste that is out there at the moment.
Well, let's talk about some of the kind of positive innovations that are happening. And like, is there any that excites you, that you think are game changers that you've seen coming through?
Yeah, I mean, from a recycling perspective, I think automation, robotics and AI, it's gonna help a lot in sort of driving that feedstock, fiber recognition, and so from a recycling perspective, I think novel technologies are going to be extremely important. It's really every type of technology can support in one part or another part of the process. I think also something that is important to acknowledge is that innovation is not only technology, it's also different ways of doing things. So I think something that's quite exciting as well is all of the alternative business models that are coming in that, you know, are sort of teaching the consumer to consume differently beyond buying. So like swapping, rental, you know, just lending a secondhand, which is buying, but a pre-used garment. So I think there's lots of innovation happening there. And I think that's essential as well to keep garments in the loop for longer, because we currently can't deal with all of the waste we have. So I think that's a huge enabler to actually postpone the generation of waste until we actually have those technologies to deal with that waste and recycle them. And then next gen materials, I think it's great to see what's happening in that space. I mean, obviously we need alternatives to the synthetics that we currently have in the market, and also to some natural fibers that are very environmentally harmful. So I think that's great, but also I acknowledge the challenge of commercially scaling these innovations. And I guess that's the challenge at the moment with every innovation that we have in the industry, that, you know, they're amazing solutions, but we really need to push for that commercial scaling and break into the existing market that is sort of relying on traditional ways of doing.
I mean, it's always difficult for, I mean, somebody who comes, you know, building a startup to kind of make these new models and new ways of doing things commercially is always going to be really challenging when you're looking at investments that have been made that see more of that short-termism rather than that long-term goal. And it's like, how do we shift that perspective when, you know, making people put money that is seen more of like a, maybe a post-growth instead of something that's like, you know, they're going to make their money back imminently.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's because we're trying to generate change and be sustainable in a system that is unsustainable itself. I mean, it's really difficult to change the system, and it's probably not going to change in terms in the next 5 to 10 years when we look at projections of consumption and waste. And so I think it's good to assume that that's not going to change, and therefore, you know, whatever is there, we need to sort of shift it. But then we really need these innovations to sort of radically shift the way we do things, like even consumption, you know. And the consumer itself, they're becoming conscious citizens. They're going to be prepared for it. I mean, the interest for sustainability is just growing. So in 5 to 10 years, I hope, buying a synthetic polyester T-shirt is, you know, who's going to do that? So I think that's the challenge, like having that not short-term but long-term vision and understanding that that's where the industry is shifting in a positive way, because it's not... It doesn't mean that economic growth is not going to be generated. It's just going to value is going to come in another form. You know, it's going to come in a sort of environmental impact and economic impact, but not necessarily relying on the extraction of resources for that. But I see a positive shift towards that in the industry. And I think more and more investors and companies overall are ready to make that shift.
Yeah. I'd love to talk to you about your PhD. Mm-hmm. Can you explain like what it is that you're actually researching?
Yeah.
If you can, because it's always difficult to explain that.
I think I've managed to find a way to explain it now. So what I'm doing is basically exploring cross-generational and cross-geographical differences in secondhand consumption, with a strong focus on the non-consumption of secondhand. So why people don't consume and why it's actually hindering them to engage with this circular business model of buying.
Oh, okay. And what have you learned so far?
Oof, that's what I'm struggling. Like now I'm in the stage of writing my findings and it's like, what should I choose to say? Because there's so much. Mm. But I think some three key learnings or findings is when looking at the experience that people have with these different circular business models of consumption, the huge part of the population that is actually not at all aware or engaging with them. Because obviously we have those conscious citizens who are buying secondhand or engaging with these alternative consumption models. But what we need to tackle really is that part that isn't, and understand why they aren't. So I think that non-consumption that is still there is one of the sort of points of interest in my research. The huge stigma that there is still towards the use of pre-used clothing. I mean, non-secondhand consumers can't even explain themselves why they aren't consuming. They're just something, and they don't know how to explain it themselves. It might be because of their scare of hygiene. They're scared of just that item being close to the body. They don't know the previous owner, or, you know, other things. And that those sort of cultural stigmas and learnings, there's a huge job to do there to unlearn those stigmas, because if we really want to transition towards circular consumption beyond secondhand, which is a more classic model, think about swapping or rental. You know, actually, we need to prepare consumers and educate them to start thinking of this as something common and not always associating consumption with the new. So I think that's another one of the key learnings. And then last, I include the mature generation in my research, which is that older generation, which obviously was born in the post-war period, and the way they consumed and dealt with clothing, we have so much to learn with that from that, because the values they have and how they treat their clothing, they care of their clothing, they repair their clothing, they share their clothing. I mean, they don't even need secondhand because their item in the wardrobe has lasted there for 30 years, and they'll just give them to their grandson or the granddaughter. So I think there's a lot to learn from that generation as well in terms of practices. I would say those are three interesting things, probably not my huge findings.
I think this is so interesting though, because touching on your point about those stigmas and what you learn, with Lonehood, with my startup, it's mm-hmm. rental, okay? Mm-hmm. And we do swapping as well. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, we still get that kind of friction for rental from consumers, like, oh, you know, the things about hygiene, I don't know where it's from. But they'll still go out and buy secondhand.
Yeah.
There's a really interesting gap, because I'm like, I don't understand why I suddenly... I mean, I guess resale is just 10 years or whatever ahead of where rental is. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way I can get it around my head. But have you noticed that there's like a change in
I think the secondhand consumer is much more established, because obviously secondhand has been a formalized market since, you know, the sort of 60s in the UK, 70s. So I think is that sort of fear for the new, such as rental or swapping. I think there's a difference as well between consumers who are consuming secondhand, because in secondhand we have many different consumers who are, you know, consuming different secondhand for many different reasons. It can be economic, it can be demographic, it can be generational, it can be the environment or not at all. Whereas I think those other models, such as, for example, swapping, is really targeted, and there's going to be more and more for that conscious consumer who actually, you know, wants to stop buying new, wants to try out new things. So I think there's probably an apprehension, like sort of a stigma towards the new things in general. It's not only the swapping or the rental, but all of the other things, even technologies that are coming into the industry. But I think it's only positive that this market is going to grow, and that, you know, consumers are going to start to see it more and more as normal. I think that with secondhand, it's just because it's been more hidden than the standard consumption, but it's been there for so long that consumers are familiar with it. So I think that familiarity is very important. But hopefully these models will be more and more familiar. And I guess even for myself, I you know, now for me, secondhand is like, yeah, secondhand, but I prefer things such as swapping. But at the beginning, it was a new way of buying. It was, you know, I'm going there and I don't know what I'm going to find. Perhaps I might not even find exactly what I wanted. Whereas within a secondhand shop, you can go in and go to the pants section.
Yeah, it's a bit more selective.
So I think, yeah, it's just a reflection, but I think it's slowly overcoming all of those stigmas and unfamiliar practices and transition towards more familiarity towards this type of models. And
there's something that's come into my mind about when I speak to you, some people that come to our swaps, or some people that rent, or some people that, you know, buy secondhand. I mean, even in my PhD, I'm talking about like digital fashion consumption, so fashion that doesn't even exist in the material world. And what I'm finding, and I don't know if you found this in your research, is a lot of kind of, particularly maybe Gen Z, who obviously we're going through this cost of living crisis now, and, you know, they want to be able to own something.
Yeah.
But then they're also the fragility of their kind of generation. They're very aware that, you know, there's not as much money. So like secondhand is really good to kind of, you know, get that satisfaction. But also they really want to own something, because we live in a time when nobody owns anything, you know, where, like, you know, we can't even buy a house. We can't even, you know, things like this plays into it. And I don't know if you've found that clothing maybe for some generations is the last thing that they can actually physically touch and own.
Yeah, I think that definitely that the sort of materiality of clothing and the easiness of buying that compared to other things is what motivates many time consumers. Mm. And many times, even with secondhand, right? Like, I say secondhand sustainable, but that's just assuming that buying secondhand is going to replace the buying of something new. I mean, we don't want to promote secondhand on the side to consuming new. And what I found is that a lot of the consumers who classify themselves as secondhand consumers, they're not necessarily buying only secondhand, but they're buying secondhand unique items or unique vintage bags just because they can't afford a new Gucci. They'll buy it secondhand. So I definitely see that sort of necessity of owning unique things and of sort of materiality and showing in secondhand. And I think from my perspective, like, it's very interesting to look at why people are buying as well, because sometimes you find that even with secondhand, people might be buying it, but it's not at all because of environmental reasons or sustainable consumption. But yeah, I see what you mean, and I definitely saw it as well.
Yeah, I think it's just trying to understand these models and their value and purpose. Like, ideally, I think it is about reducing our need for physical items.
Yeah.
But is it actually happening? This kind of attitude behavior gap that mm-hmm. you kind of find, like, is it just kind of offering another way to consume?
Yeah.
Whether it's resale, whether it's rental, whether it's digital fashion items. I mean, in my research, is, you know, it's definitely not showing that it's going to replace physical. In fact, it's just going to offer another way of, like, being able to get a fashion fix in a different context.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a challenge, I think, to
shift. The proportion of consumers who are reducing their consumption and only using these models as an alternative is very, very low. But that's just because this is becoming recently a challenge. And you know, isn't that sort of scale of adoption of, like, coming up at the moment. So I think it's going to come a point in which this replacement is actually going to happen, hopefully, but we're not there yet. So I think we also have to be careful with really promoting these other ways of consuming yeah. on the side, rather than here you can replace and start your sort of active journey as a more conscious consumer on top of reducing your consumption and changing your values overall. I think it's also a lot about values and putting your limits as a consumer and starting to become conscious, because I think when you start to become conscious, that's when you actually start taking these decisions based on environmental impact.
It's not an overnight thing, is it? It's going to be a journey to get there. I mean, what, you know, you already start seeing people like, oh no, I like secondhand because I like the story behind it. These are things that, like, you probably wouldn't have heard a consumer saying maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah,
I remember I'm working in a vintage shop in uni, and it was like, there was a very specific vintage people that used to come into the shop, or they'd be like, absolutely not.
Yeah,
like,
you know.
But now it's like...
More openness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in your research about this cross-cultural, cross-generational aspect. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit more.
So I'm basically exploring Sweden, England and Spain, which are similar countries, but at the same time, very, very different. And the secondhand market has evolved very differently in each country. Spain, it was a country that was, you know, under an authoritarian regime until the 80s. So the access to information of the population and how they lived at the civil war, also after the Second World War, like, obviously has affected how they deal with clothes and how they see secondhand. Because whereas in the UK or in England specifically, which is where I'm looking at, in the 50s, you know, the concept of charity shop already existed. People in Spain have not been born knowing what secondhand is or what a charity shop is. And there's not even availability of those shops as there is, for example, in England. So I think that sort of lack of familiarity and unengagement with secondhand is a big difference between England and Spain, for example. And in Sweden, what I can see is that extreme sort of consciousness across generations, even across mature generations, which interestingly didn't used to consume secondhand, but now are extremely open to it because of the planet and because of their grandchildren. And so there's a lot of cross-cultural differences. And then in terms of cross-generational, I thought I was going to find more cross-generational difference. I was hopeful that I would find that the younger generation, you know, is more keen to consume secondhand. And I did find that in some of the countries. But in others, there's still that lack of consciousness and engagement with these type of models. But it's, I'm in the process of writing my findings now, and it's challenging. But I guess overall, what I found is just that need to transition towards these models and really target the non-engagement, because those are the people who we need to overcome that stigma, because that stigma is not only towards secondhand. That stigma comes from underlying values that are going to be also towards swapping, towards rental, towards recycled clothes. I was reading an article last week that people are still sort of scared of using a recycled item because of the connotation of it, because of the fact that it's been waste. So I think it's about changing the conceptions that we have around these models and these ways of consuming, and making it something fun, and, you know, rather than associating with it having been a previously worn item or waste, basically.
Yeah. So what can we do to change that? You've spoken a bit about, you know, education. Is that?
I think personally, education is extremely important, and it can totally shift the values, which is what I think is needed in order to transition towards other ways of consuming. So I think education, both on a sort of citizen level and on a school level and on a university level and apprenticeship level, like, we need to incorporate these values into everything and stop thinking, or thinking on the side of growth, also about environmental impact and ethical impact, of course. So I think education is extremely important, and especially in fashion schools as well, because those are the future leaders of the industry.
So we've spoken about so much today. We're talking about everything on an industry level, on a company level. We spoke about infrastructure, new legislations. And we spoke about your PhD research, which is so interesting. And I think just what I'm getting from it, this whole conversation, if I was going to put it in a nutshell, is trying to redefine the meaning of waste, the meaning of new, and what we value, which is going to be a journey for every single consumer.
Yeah, definitely. It's creating a whole new way of seeing things, of doing things, and even creating a whole new supply chain, which wasn't there before, to deal with all that waste, prolonged use through circular business models. So I think it's, like you said, redefining new, redefining ownership, and redefining waste, for sure, and changing values.
For a new fashion system.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Lauren, for joining. I can't wait to read your PhD and to see what you're going to get up to next with the UK FT.
Thank you.